So, I guess more of the relevance of all that backstory and how it plays into my participation in promoting animation and the convention scene that brought about the innovations we brought about. One of the things my friend Lee and I were into were the high-tech, state-of-the-art, you know, elitist-like viewing of media. So we were into widescreen. We were one of those in a group into widescreen before people understood it.
So by elitist, you really mean like high-end?
High-end.
Right.
You know, we went for the best monitors, the best sound systems.
So technical sophistication as opposed to attitude.
Exactly. Okay. That's good. That's good. When we went to purchase something, which led to me buying these tapes initially, and not just getting someone's fifth generation, which was the norm. It also led to us buying laser discs. And
well, that was the holy grail at that time, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they still stand, they tower above anything that's released today just because of the sheer volume that they take up and the massive packaging and all the artwork that went with them.
I have got a shelf down there that... So, one of the things that were... that added to our mystique and some people's disdain towards us was that we would have all these store-bought tapes and store-bought CDs and laser discs, and we wouldn't share them. We wouldn't loan them. And maybe we'll make you a copy. But we only did that because if we got something of equal trade. So, in a sense, we were kind of snobby about the whole thing.
Well, that also has... reach a point of diminishing returns because as your own library builds up, it gets increasingly difficult to find anybody to trade with.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It does. And these, like my tapes, for instance, in most cases, I wouldn't watch it no matter how long it took until I had my deck set up to make the first recording. Yeah. And then usually record off that recording. I would rarely ever watch a tape more than twice. So those tapes out there, they've only been viewed through a machine, a high-end machine, twice at the most.
So after that, you would just look at copies of that?
We'd only view the copies and make copies from the copies. Mm-hmm. And we use the high-end machine, so... most people really didn't notice much, the degradation. And it would have to be a very special trade for us to copy right off the original.
Right.
When the Laserdisc came out, it was a little bit different. We gave those out a little more freely.
Sure. Well, it was less volatile as a media.
Yeah. But most people didn't have the high-end machines that we were investing in. Mm-hmm. They just had these as basic a VHS as possible, they couldn't possibly see the difference between the copy and so forth. Mm-hmm. But one of my first conventions was with my friend Ron, who was the book buyer at Tower. Mm-hmm. He was into conventions before me, and he was collecting as well the animation, various animations. Angel's Egg, that's that movie. It was a crazy movie. But
and conventions at that time, you're talking about comic book conventions?
At that point, we're talking about your general regional science fiction convention.
Okay.
There's one big one here every year that's NorwestCon, and a variety of smaller ones. SakuraCon is actually now the bigger one. I think now it's taken over in this region.
And is that a general interest, or is it does it have a Japanese focus?
Well, at the time, SakuraCon is very Japanese,
right,
cosplay kind of thing. But at the time, NorwestCon, and I think still today, NorwestCon is more of a science fiction literature. So you had authors, you had some media, you had every gambit. You had gaming, board games and role playing, and so you had a big spectrum. One of the things he did was show video, and there were various places that showed video, and it wasn't organized. So somebody like Ron could get a room. He just rent one of the rooms, and he'd hook up a VCR to a TV and play videos. Mm-hmm. He also was into selling the books and stuff that he would get. So he was good at that. He would sell stuff. But he was showing videos. Now, at the time, early on like that, there were no media rooms. There was no organized animation rooms.
So you just open up a hotel room and put it on the TV,
yeah,
there, right?
And that was the norm throughout the country.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the first time when we did that, I went with him on that. And you could get 15 people in there, crammed, watching something no one understood. You know, and that room heated up really fast.
And then there was probably somebody, either Ron or yourself, giving commentary, right?
There would be some commentary sometimes. Sometimes, once in a while, I remember one time we had some outline for a movie. Mm-hmm. Remember that? We talked it over. It was very prehistoric, I guess, in some sense.
Sure.
I did a couple of those with Ron. I also got... Now, the same friends that I was working with at Isomedia also started a convention series, DreamCon. And it was literary. Same thing. The idea was to put it 6 months in between NorwestCon and have big guests. We had big guests, good history, good 10-year history. But they wanted us to do an actual video room and not just have this rental room with a TV playing. And Lee and I were the perfect ones to do it because we were technophiles with an interest. In my first convention with them, we started off by renting a big screen TV. I think the big screen TV at the time wasn't too big. Could have been that. It was something like that, maybe a little larger. You know, cathode
30,
ray.
40 inches.
Yeah, 30, 40 inches, cathode ray. Could have been 50.
Big box, right?
Big ass box. We sit in the center, and we took some, you know, hotel chairs and lined them up, theater style, mm-hmm, and ran it. Ran, just walked up, put up a tape, ran it. Following year, we thought to do something different. We rented two big screens, put them side by side, well, a little distance, but side by side, but gave everyone more view because we had a larger room. Gave everyone more choice to view. We had a sound system, sounded great. The following year after that, we had one big projection system and two large cathode ray monitors. So we had a three monitor, so everyone could see. We had big sound. We were big on the theatrical sound.
Okay.
Big subwoofer.
And I gather you're on the staff of the convention at this
point.
We're
on the staff.
So there's no conflict about one side of the convention being about literary aspects and the other side being...
No,
video.
We were our own entity.
Okay.
So, we were the media people. We were the media guys.
That did occasionally cause breakup and controversy among other conventions because typically in the Midwest they would be literary based and the slow creep of other media was resisted.
I see.
Quite strongly in the beginning.
I see.
And eventually the media took over because the attendees would become younger year after year and they would gravitate toward that.
Right.
And so over time, you saw a whole generation turn over. Was it similar here?
Our attendance grew, which I think was more about the animation and the quality and what we were doing with it. But the general attendance for the convention was pretty steady in growth because people wanted to see who we had. I mean, we had... For authors, I mean, we had Alan Dean Foster, and we had a big Star Wars author. I mean, we had named notable people,
okay.
And they did attract attendees.
Right.
Not being focused on the rest of the convention at the time, I can just say that our attendance and people coming to see us grew through the years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it detracted or took away from the rest.
Right.
And I don't think it did that with NoWestCon either.
And what about the age range? Did it go down as time went on?
I don't think it did.
Yeah.
I guess I could say that there were more youths in the latter years.
And there certainly are now.
I mean, yeah, now, I mean, even from the stuff I see online... I can see that there are a lot more youth.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess it's not something I paid attention to, but I do recall more younger people near the last few years than I do remember early on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's possible that had happened, like you're saying.
And it'll be interesting to watch over the next 10 years or so if they stick with it. Because I think... if you gravitate toward something in a more mature age group, let's say earlier mid-20s, you're more likely to stay with it, whereas if you come into it as a teenager, your tastes are probably going to change, and you may gravitate away.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that everyone in the 80s that I knew who got into anime in their 20s is still into it or is still connected in
mm-hmm.
some way. But if you came in as a teenager, maybe you moved on. So it'll be interesting to see how this body of fans evolves over the next dozen years or so.
We were making these theatrical presentations in a media room, and no one else is still doing it. And we had gone to NoWestCon and a few other conventions through the year, and people were still going into rooms... with a VCR hookup.
Right.
Well, I can't remember if it was the third year or the fourth year. We decided we were going to run the thing like a TV station.
Huh.
And we spent months prepping, put out a schedule, we made a schedule. I still have the tapes of the commercials. And we prepped all these commercials. 30 seconds. And timed out all the spots and set the tapes up to coordinate through the timeline of the convention.
And was it still in a single room? Or
this was now in a big... This would have been in a huge... Oh, not huge.
Yeah. It was still a destination room as opposed to
yes.
a signal that would be broadcast through the hotel.
Well, that was the year following we actually hooked up what we were presenting into the signal,
okay.
into the house. But what we did was we prepped all the commercials and we had all our TV station in the back of the room and we were running it, queuing, yeah. prepping, setting, shoot, you know, running the commercials, put the commercial set up that time has come. We were on time, scheduled, and we hit, you know, we do our movies right at the hour.
So what was the content of the commercials? Did you create them yourself?
Yeah, we would take clips. I'll show them to you. We'd take clips of something, and then just let it run, put graphics over it. Uh-huh. That was the other thing we were into. We could do graphics. Nobody else was doing graphics, because we were already starting our subtitling. So we made these commercials, and we made things slick, you know, for the time, anyway.
Yes.
And nobody had seen that. Nobody gone into a convention and actually watched an animation TV presentation like that. And it just so happened that year, we had a friend, another convention person from San Francisco, from Baycon. I believe her name was Melissa Wilson. Mm-hmm. And she came up because she wanted to attend the convention for something and to see us, I think.
Oh, and Baycon was the big one in San Francisco, right?
I think that was one of the, I believe it was one of the main, I can't give you a direct answer, but okay. I know it was big enough that they had, it was very similar to a regional convention.
Right, but it became sort of famous among the anime fan community because a fellow by the name of Torrin Smith created this massive translation guide one year that was like a guidebook to the entire medium, and it got all over the place. Copies of that thing circulated across the country within a few weeks.
Interesting.
And so Baycon sort of became synonymous with this mecca of anime fandom,
mm-hmm.
I think, represented entirely through that one publication. And even now, I don't know, is the convention still going? Is it?
I don't know.
Still going year to year?
We knew Torrent, actually. Torrent, very well.
Yeah.
Lee was actually going through him to get options, buy options for the Gundam TV series.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Buying options.
Buying the option. He was going to buy a six... We were buying a six-month option because we were looking at actually... Well, I forget what Lee wanted to do, if he wanted to actually title it or if he actually wanted to dub it for a broadcast.
Huh.
That was...
So you were looking at packaging it up for American television?
Mm-hmm.
Through a local station?
That part, I don't know how far we got with that because this was mostly Lee.
Okay.
Lee was really heading on that. But Melissa was up. She saw what we were doing. She was blown away by it. She had no clue that this was possible, that we were running this animation TV station for this convention in such a way that you could walk in and we had the big screen and we had the big sound and we were had the slick graphics. There's nothing anyone had ever seen before. People were still running VCRs on TVs and rooms. So, we got more noticed that way amongst some of the animation community.
Yeah, well, that's going to stand out.
It did. We went to NorwestCon. One of the things when we go to these other conventions and sneak in to check it out and just see what they're doing. That year, there was this kind of half-assed, semi-attempt trying to replicate what we were doing. And we laughed. Obviously, it was just not, it was someone's attempt. We appreciated the attempt, but we saw that we had some effect. And it was also that year, so maybe we can lock it down, the year Akira was released on DVD, we had made this arrangement where we were going to get Akira, the DVD, the Laserdisc rather, we were going to get that shipped to us. We were supposed to get it 3 days before the convention. And we were promoting Akira for the first time in America.
Wow.
You know, I'm sure people had tapes and all like that, but we were going to be the first convention to air it.
Well, I seem to recall the movie came out originally in 88, so this would have been probably 89.
Yeah, whatever year that was actually released. And then we got really nervous because it didn't show up the day before. Mm-hmm. And then we got extra nervous, or the 2 days before, extra nervous. It didn't show up the day before.
So there wouldn't have been time to fan sub it.
We didn't plan on it. Okay. We had no plans. We just planned on putting it up there.
Yeah.
And running it raw.
Yeah. You don't really need subs to sell that movie. At least not at the time.
No. But when we found out that there was some sort of address error, because we were calling, we had it actually delivered to the hotel.
Oh.
And it got there that morning, late morning, and we hadn't planned on showing it until that night, Saturday night. So we had the day before, I guess. But it got there Friday late morning. And I remember how relieved we were, because that was our big thing.
It was a close call.
It was close.
And I imagine the room was probably packed.
It was packed.
Yeah.
You know, not only did we have the animation fans, we had non-animation fans who had heard about this, heard about Akira. And we all watched it together in awe, raw off, what, three sides? I think it was a three-sided disc set.
And you played the disc directly, right?
There right, was not we a just company. Played it on. Yeah. Everyone was just mesmerized. Mm-hmm. And we had the big screen, we had the big sound, and it was theatrical. People walked away just, oh. But, so we had this progression in trying to present the animation more theatrically. We were presenting it cleaner than the multi-generational. We decided we were never going to show copies.
So this was the next best thing to going to Japan itself.
I think that's, I think in some respects. We got a somewhat of a small reputation, I guess, for not showing crappy copies, you know? And the fact that we had store-bought tapes and DVD, laser discs, people were impressed with that. And we also didn't just stick with the animation. Obviously, we couldn't fulfill, 16 hours a day with that.
Right.
Fortunately, we were aficionados to other subjects. So we had laser discs and movies and of other subjects, our favorites, you know. So we had a great media room, and that progressed for years until the convention was just like, we did our 10-year mission, and it's time to move on.
So I imagine the other subjects were things like monster movies and
we had a few
tokusatsu and things like that. Right?
We had a few monster movies, but we also had a lot of domestic. This was still new to a lot of people to actually go see The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in a theatrical presentation.
Oh, yeah.
So we had a lot of domestic films, which also filled that room. Because, at the time, there was not a lot of high-end in the house, generally speaking. But we started from making early on photocopies of our program and kind of binding them together. Very simple dot matrix printed. To finally, near the end, where I actually fell in love with the internet because I had designed with someone else the entire book, this entire 7x5 book, square bound, which would have been considered a MOOC in Japan.
So this was at the point when desktop publishing was at your disposal.
It was starting to become a thing. Oh, yeah. We were big into the computers. So we had that advantage that, a lot of the fans didn't have.
Right.
So I fell in love with the internet because we designed this thing, we transmitted it to the printer, made the arrangements through the the young internet, the young dial-up, to get it arranged for delivery and all of that. And I didn't have to go anywhere. And when it arrived at the convention, that these boxes, that's when I realized for the first time the potential of the internet and how it's going to change everything. Because it went from nothing into this physical book, and mind-blowing. But
data becomes an actual, real, physical object.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Star Trek replicator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boom, there it is. And
dynamic duo.
So we had progressed as well. Again, most of the, from my experience, and I have to say, I don't have a lot of national knowledge on how other conventions progressed, just stories I hear from others through time. But my understanding is most of the media in other conventions, when they progressed, were part of the main program book. They didn't produce their own. They didn't produce their own book. And at this point, we had commissioned artists. You know, we had these we sold the publications. I think we even broke even. I have a banner. I had this banner made. Fantasy Roadshow 93. That's what that was. Mm-hmm. Fantasy Roadshow 93. It's still hanging in my mom's office because I never took it down. But it was a beautiful blue banner. But it really progressed into real big promotion, almost professional promotion without just us fans. Mm. And a lot of people came. The hotel that we were in is actually up the street about north of us, about 7 miles, 8 miles. And it's a popular place because it's kind of it's not too far from the Canadian border. It's a couple hours. And we would always get a lot of Canadians come down. You know, it was worth that 2-hour trip. So we had a lot of Canadians, and we had influence into the Lower Mainland, because we found out later that some of the fans that ran conventions up there were emulating some of the things we were doing.
And now it's commonplace.
It is.
Maybe it's unheard of to go to an anime convention or even a general interest convention with an anime room to see anything less than the quality you're describing.
Yeah, I don't know how much influence we'd had nationally. I would only presume that this would just be a natural progression. Uh-huh. We were just early at it. But I, you know, knowing what happened at BayCon and seeing what happened locally, it's possible that people that were emulating us, other people came from other parts of the country to the bigger conventions and maybe took some of that back with them. But it wasn't too long after we stopped that we were finding out how conventions were doing what we did. To me, that's, you know, it's a small thing. It's really, you know, it's not a big life changer, but it's something that I'm a bit proud of to have been involved with. If it wasn't for my television experience, perhaps growing up and having the Japanese Nationals influence and all of that, it might not have not happened. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all those dominoes are linked and they fell together in a way that. Now, I mentioned growing up poor, so I didn't have a lot of things as a child that a lot of people had commonly. One of the things that happens when you grow up not having a particular thing is you compensate that in your adult life, and it doesn't matter what it is. Somebody never had a car somehow finds the money to buy 15 cars because, you know, well, I ended up buying At one point, I must have had 8 VCRs, because I never had a VCR. I had to rip, you know. You know, I have several DVD players now, and we didn't have a lot of food. We were on food stamps early on, food banks. My mom, you know, cooked bare essentials because that's all we had. You know, one of the things that I strive for the longest time is I never let that refrigerator go empty. You know, I always compensate. And I'm a little bit ashamed that I waste more food than I should. But I'm always making sure there's food in the house.